Okay, welcome to another episode of New Books in Terrorism and Organised Crime. My name is Mark Locks, your host from Brisbane in Australia. And today we're talking to Jared Gilbert about his new book, Patched, The History of Gangs in New Zealand. How are you going, Jared?
Very well, thanks, mate.
That's good, that's good. And which part of New Zealand are you in at the moment?
Christchurch.
The earthquake city.
Indeed, yeah. Thankfully, we're over those now, and we're sort of on the way back up. But it's been a hell of a journey.
Yes, yes. I've got lots of in-laws from Christchurch. I mean, from Christchurch, because they're pretty much all over here now. So,
as some Kiwis are.
Yes, but thank you very much for coming on the show. And I think the first thing we'll talk about, as I said, is a bit of background about you. So, tell us about yourself, where you've come from, and how you ended up doing this sort of research and ended up writing this book.
Look, I think how I got here was a terrible mix of ignorance and arrogance, really. I mean, I've certainly not, I haven't come from a background with any gangs in it, very middle class. I don't think I've even sort of seen a gang member, really. And I was sitting in a lecture theatre hearing that there was a dearth of research on gangs in New Zealand. And just at that time, there was numerous laws going through Parliament targeting gangs, and I thought, well, isn't it interesting that we're putting these quite significant laws through, and yet we know nothing about them? And so I did a small project, and then one thing leads to another, and next thing you know, you're in the mongrel mob headquarters, at 3 a.m. getting drunk, and you don't really know how you got there.
Well, that was probably true for a lot of other people in the room with you at the time.
Maybe.
And I mean, I can understand you can get the opportunity to do the research, but the book, this excellent book, I thoroughly enjoyed this book. How did the actual offer for publication come around?
Well, actually, while I was conducting the research, obviously people were quite interested in it because it hadn't been done before, and gangs are probably overstated in New Zealand. Their significance is overstated, but nevertheless, they've had a very important, long, and often quite violent and intriguing history in New Zealand. So I think everybody has sort of a curiosity about them. And so when I was doing the research, there was a fair bit of interest around it, and a couple of or three publishers actually approached me interested in the book, and there was one that was just really persistent, actually, and we ended up sort of I thought he was a good bloke, and that was that. Really, it was all reasonably straightforward.
Yeah, because you're in a nice, unique situation. And in case there's any people who listen to this who don't realise the size of New Zealand, what's the population now? About 4 million.
That's right, about around there. Yeah.
Yeah. So you've got this nice enclosed, reasonably small community where someone could actually do the history of all the gangs.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, it was. Yeah, that is right. I mean, there was a fair bit of travel involved, obviously, and I mean, at times I was out in the field for sort of 2 months at a time, which was sort of quite tiring getting around the place, particularly when you're in environments that are obviously very heavy drinking and partying and quite violent. So they felt like incredibly long trips, but yeah, though I was able to sort of to gather up, the history, a very broad history, which, to be quite honest, is one of the reasons it took me so long, because it was a very, it was a sort of a big topic. But you're right, I was lucky that I could do it. And I think this is, I mean, it is a big study, and it's a fairly big book. But like anything, I think there's so much more room for investigation. I certainly don't think it's definitive by any stretch. It's just a good foundation, perhaps, for further work.
Yes, but as I said before, the fact that you can cover all of the gangs at once provides a quite unique viewpoint on gangs, whereas other people in other countries, even in Australia, which is only 5 times the size of New Zealand, no one would ever attempt to cover every type of gang in one publication. At least not historically.
Yeah, I did want that, and I think in so many ways you can read the book as almost a history of New Zealand. I mean, I sort of try and use the gangs to look at sort of social, economic, and political situations that are happening throughout those decades. Because while the gangs sort of do live in their own sort of world, and they sort of reject the outsiders. And mainstream society, they are deeply embedded and influenced by what happens in society. And we can see that with their evolutionary progress over the years. As society changes, so do the gangs.
That's right. anyone who reads the book will definitely see the change in the nature of government in New Zealand, and they'll probably see the same reflection in their own. Anyone from a Western country would see the same reflections in their own governments, from fear, moral panics and conservatism to somewhat more enlightened and not necessarily completely enlightened points of view of how they're going to deal with the gangs.
Yeah, well, look, I think Western democracies have tended to... Yeah, they share similar characteristics, don't they? So they do tend to deal with these problems in reasonably similar ways. So I think, yeah, I think there are significant parallels between what's happened in New Zealand and elsewhere. And you know, you say that, you know, that term moral panic. Clearly, that's not a New Zealand concept, and I think it's one that can be applied to gangs the world over. Really, you know, when there's a sort of high profile incidents, you know, and there's political mileage to be made out of it, often the response is more about political efficacy rather than sort of good public policy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, on that point, let's run ourselves back to the 1950s and start off with the rock and roll era. And can you tell us about the formation of the gangs and how they learnt from American culture?
Yeah, well, look, New Zealand is really unique in so much as the Hells Angels formed a chapter in Auckland pre-came in 1959, officially established in 61, but certainly were established before that, probably in 1960. And this fundamentally changed New Zealand's gang scene. And because this chapter, just to put this into a wider perspective, you know, that was only the fourth chapter anywhere in the world and the first chapter outside of California. So, you know, that happened in Auckland, New Zealand seems amazing, but our gangs before that time, whether they were milk bar cowboys who rode motorcycles or sort of bodgies that were sort of street gangs, were fluid in nature and they had a fleeting existence. So gangs would sort of spring up. They were a youth phenomenon. And as a prominent leader or a prominent member of a group got married or got a job and settled down, then the gang would kind of dissolve and another one would sort of spring up to take its place. So you had this kind of constant rejuvenation of these gangs sort of springing up, falling away, and there was no sort of permanence either to the gangs themselves nor to the membership.
Yep. Now, I might just explain that to listeners what a bodgie is. I mean, the English would call them the rockers as opposed to the mods.
Yeah.
They're the leather-clad, brill-creamed hair.
Yeah, actually, perhaps more the teddy boys for us, the bodgies. Yeah. The milk bar cowboys were us for the rockers.
Mm. Right.
So they're two just sort of distinct youth movements.
Mm.
So what happened with the Hells Angels came is that suddenly they had a common identifier in the back patch. They had an organisational structure, like a president and a secretary or a treasurer, a sergeant at arms and a road captain. So they had these sort of hierarchical, you know, organisational structures. They had clearly defined rules. They got clubhouses, and so they built up this. They developed this thing that existed over and above the sum of its members. So something else was created. Now, what that meant was, when people left the gang, so you still had this rejuvenation, it was still a young man's game. When people left, the positions would sort of be filled because this entity kind of existed. So this template that was established by the Hells Angels and quickly copied by all others meant that the gangs that formed in that time have existed in New Zealand ever since. None that have that don't have that structure, and only the ones that did survived over time. And so it was a fundamental transformation between sort of fleeting youth groups through to these fixed gangs that existed in New Zealand and still exist to this day.
Right. And let's run through the sort of gangs that are there, because there's some difference between the gangs that are European-based and then more Indigenous-based. And maybe we need a bit of a background on the nature of the two different parts of the community as well.
Yeah, well, initially in New Zealand in the 50s and even sort of into the 60s, or at least to the early part of the 60s, the gang situation, whether it be street gangs or those that rode motorcycles, were Pākehā, as we call them, which is European New Zealanders, white New Zealanders. Now, what happened was beginning to happen in the late 60s, in the late 50s, but certainly into the 1960s, was an urban drift where Maori, the indigenous people of New Zealand, were beginning to move into the cities, often because they were dispossessed of land, but equally because they were looking for a better lifestyle, really, you know, work and money and what the city could offer. Now, what happened is there's this massive clash of culture where the traditional sort of folk ways and mores that bound Maori society together in the country didn't really work in the cities, and they sort of, you know, and they struggled to adjust. And of course, there was racism and the like. Whilst New Zealand's race relations have traditionally been seen as very good, nevertheless, it existed. And so there was this conflict and problems. And what we're very aware from research, not just my research, gang research, but gang research all around the world, is that when you're faced with these certain difficulties in city situations, particularly urban and city situations, gang formation is inevitable. If you've got problems at school, you've got problems with employment, and racial issues and the like, then these ethnic minorities tend to form gangs. And this is exactly what happened. So what was a Pākehā issue suddenly and quickly became a Maori issue, and Maoris begin to dominate the gangs. Now, while some joined the motorcycle clubs, largely they joined, formed large street gangs. And but unlike street gangs around the world, in fact, unique to New Zealand, they put on back patches. They adopted the look and the structure of the Hells Angels and the outlaw motorcycle clubs. And so hence why our big street gangs here, like the Black Power and the Mongrel Mob, all wear back patches. They look like bikies, but they don't go around on motorcycles. So, yeah, a very interesting scene. And what that did mean is it meant that they had, all of those factors, that organisational hierarchy, the common identifiers and the like, that allowed them to achieve longevity as well. And so they became mainstays of the gang scene, in fact, dominated it.
Right, right. So do you want to run us through some of the major gangs, these long-surviving gangs in New Zealand?
Well, there's a plethora of them, really. The main street gangs in New Zealand and the primary rivals, by far and away the biggest groups in New Zealand are the Mongrel Mob and the Black Power. Their demographics are near identical, primarily Maori, some Pacific, a splattering of Pākehā or white. Poor, of course, similar education, similar backgrounds, all of these things, yet formidable enemies. And then you've got some other smaller street gangs, like the Nomad and the Headhunters, say. And then the outlaw motorcycle clubs, which, anything from the Hells Angels and the Bandidos, that are quite a recent arrival, and the Rebels, which Australians will be very familiar with, through to homegrown ones, Devil's Henchmen, Epitaph Riders, Highway 61, numerous groups.
Yep. And what's the interplay? You're talking about rivalry between Black Power and Mongrel Mob. Is there any interplay between the outlaw motorcycle gangs and the street gangs?
Yeah, look, there has been. Traditionally, the biggest rivals have been, they sort of stick to their own set, so it's bikey versus bikey and street gang versus street gang. They tend to be. But in communities where, say, there's only one outlaw biker group and one street gang, then they'll find ways to fight themselves because everybody needs an enemy. But because they do share a similar look and they've got patches, they are sort of seen as all sort of all ripe to be friends or enemies.
Yeah. Yeah. What sort of activity are we talking about here? I mean, historically, is it really just the normal, what I call the buff-ed street violence of drinking and punching, street racing, that sort of thing? Is there any movement into the classic outlaw motorcycle gang organized crime activity?
Yeah, look, initially when these were youth groups now, sort of in the inception, sort of in the 60s and 70s in New Zealand, it was all drinking and brawling, and that was it. You might have got, the odd bike would get stolen and there might be the odd armed robbery or something like that, but largely boisterous sort of activities rather than profit-driven criminal activities. Now, I mentioned that with the development of back patches and the hierarchical structure and the rule base that the Hells Angels brought, that the gangs started to achieve longevity. For a long time, even though the gangs survived, the turnover was very high. They were still youth groups, largely, men in their late teens or perhaps early 20s. Now, what happened in the 1980s, really, when the economy fell through the floor and unemployment rose, was that there was sort of no immediate out for them. In the past, employment was full, so if a gang member got sick of the gang or sort of grew up or matured, they could get a job and that was an easy out for them. when that door was closed, when the economy no longer allowed them to do that, we saw membership, the age of membership increase exponentially. So suddenly we've got, older men in their 30s and 40s in these gangs because they just never left.
Mm.
Now, as they sort of lost that sort of boisterous adventurism and that sort of brawling, they kind of looked around and went, well, how do I make a crust out of this? And so what we started to see was the moves into profit-driven crime, primarily the drug trade. Now, in the 1990s, it was quite common, not universal, but quite common that the groups themselves would engage in what we would consider organized criminal activity, so that, they would sit around and go, right, we've got, 10 ounces to sell. Everyone's going to do this, or we've got a tinny house down here, like a drug house that's going to sell the drugs. And so it was quite organized. Now, what happened in the 1990s, the Proceeds of Crimes Act came along, and there was greater use of interception warrants and bugging and things like this. And the gangs went, hang on, one bug now, and we're all taken out, and we'll lose our clubhouse through the Proceeds of Crimes Act. The state can take the property and things like this. So they went, all right, we've got to knock this on the head. So what we see now, the model that runs, is that there are criminals within the gangs,
yep,
who deal drugs or whatever, have burglary rings, whatever. But they're not, as a general rule, almost universal, in fact, they're not organized as a mafia would be organized, if you know what I mean. That they're, they're just people that happen to be wearing patches who conduct criminal activity, but the groups themselves are not per se criminal.
That's exactly what we're seeing here, the same thing, the same age range and the demographics of membership and the same activity of criminal organisations within the gang as opposed, yeah, to the gang being a criminal organisation.
Yeah, which I don't know how it is over there, but certainly, and I suspect it's the same. That's not well understood in New Zealand. In fact,
no.
I think if you took a poll at any time, you'd say that the gangs were responsible for all of the drugs and that they're running like mafia organisations, whereas in reality they're responsible for a very small, statistically, through arrest rates and incarceration rates, a very small percentage of the drug trade.
Yes.
And do not operate as organised criminal groups, but that's contrary to popular opinion. And one of the reasons for that, of course, is because there is such electoral advantage in the gangs. Politicians can make all sorts of wild accusations, and because the gangs don't speak to the media, they tend to stick quite naturally in the public mind.
Yeah, no, that is exactly the same situation here, and I've done more media in the last 3 months than I've done in my life trying to explain exactly what you just said to the people of Australia. So,
but is it difficult? Is it difficult because when these views have become so entrenched in the popular consciousness, to squeeze them out, even if you've got all of the statistics and all of the evidence in the world, is still not easy.
No, it is not. It is not. But books like yours might help. That's for sure.
I'd like to think so, yeah.
That sort of nicely brings us into what is the government and police response to gangs in New Zealand?
Look, the police, aren't they? They're not social science scientists, and nor should we expect them to be. So they've really only got one response to it, and that's to crack down on these buggers, that's been the response from the 1950s right through. Often they've been sort of told that they need to sort of move in one direction or the other, but the underlying response for them is just go hard at them and just get them. Now, whilst this is quite understandable, and there have been some excellent examples of some very, very good policing when the gangs in New Zealand breach sort of the gang community balance, as I call it, like when they step outside of what the community's prepared to accept, the cops can be very, very good and very, very effective at dealing with that. But as they do from time to time in New Zealand, they get too zealous. They go too hard at groups when perhaps they're not doing, too hard. If one group misbehaves and they go at all of the groups in the community, and so some groups feel they're being unduly picked on or targeted, then what it does do, and this is very well highlighted in my work, is that it tends to lead to gang cohesion. So poorly targeted police activity and overzealous police activity has a contrary effect. It hardens the groups, draws them together, and creates a greater commitment. So instead of breaking them apart, it actually makes them stronger, which as a very most unfortunate consequence.
Well, it's actually very similar to what happens in anti-terrorist activity. I had a PhD student who actually calls it iatrogenic activity. It's a medical term meaning where you go into a doctor goes to heal somebody and ends up causing more harm than good.
Oh, I like that term.
Yes, he'll be very happy for you to borrow it. So yes, it's well documented through history in people who fight insurgencies and terrorist groups that they exactly that same response.
But once again, and you talked about the frustrations, or we both talked about the frustrations of trying to communicate difficult messages or more correct interpretations of the scene to the public. Well, trying to change the police mind, the minds of the police are is even harder. They have a fairly fixed view about the gangs, and it's very, very hard to change that.
Well, they're seeing it all from one particular perspective, as you were saying. So it
Look, in so many ways, I don't blame them. In the same ways, I don't blame the public, because you can see how this comes about. I mean, when I was spending time in the field, I'd be standing, say, in a car park at a fast food joint or wherever I was, with some gang members, and we're just sort of hanging out, and they're all talking, and joking about and laughing, and then suddenly the cops will come along, and that sort of change, and next thing you know, they're throwing abuse and the like. Well, see, the cops only, if the police are only ever seeing that, they're only ever locking them up when they've undertaken criminal activity. It's quite easy to see how they would gain a jaundiced view. I mean, it's quite natural, I'm sure.
Yeah, and then you get that spiral, because then the gang members also only see the police responding like that.
Yeah, exactly.
And then, they feed each other.
And this is where, you know, the police have to be professional in everything they do. And New Zealand police they're uncorruptible. They really are. They might break the rule from time to time, or historically at least, not so much now, to get a conviction, but they will not take it backhanded. So there's much that the New Zealand public should feel very proud of the New Zealand police. But from time to time, they do get, you know, there's always an errant cop who will sort of go overboard, and the damage that sort of does, you know, it sort of just sends things, backwards in relation to good policing. But they don't like to be criticised, the cops, I've got to say.
Yeah, but you did have one Prime Minister, I believe, who actually associated himself with the gangs for a while.
Look, absolutely remarkable.
Yeah, Conservative Prime Minister.
Yeah, a Conservative Prime Minister who indeed was at his worst in dealing with sort of race relations. I think early on in his Prime Ministership, he said he'd ban young Maori louts, you know, indigenous louts, to the countryside and things like this. You know, he was a hard, tough-nosed, sort of dictatorial type man, really. But he, for whatever reason, he got a soft spot for the gangs and wanted to put them to work and try and turn them, really tried to turn them around. And he didn't just do this sort of, he didn't just sort of send his people in to kind of do this, you know, the bureaucrats or the social workers or whatever. He went and did it. He really rolled up his sleeves himself. And there's one amazing story of him meeting Black Power, a large street gang, one of the big two street gangs in New Zealand. He was meeting them at a tavern, at a pub in Wellington. And the country's capital, and surrounded. He was quite a short man, and surrounded by all these big Black Power members. The publican didn't know what was going on, fearing a riot. He tossed them all out. So the Prime Minister actually got booted out of a pub in Wellington. You know, the police were called and all of this. And he went back to their clubhouse, and he was drinking whiskey with them. Rob Muldoon, the Prime Minister, wasn't afraid of a drink, and he was drinking whiskey with them. And one young gang member was flicking the dregs of his beer at him, sort of surreptitiously, kind of, I don't know, just sort of, maybe he was a bit drunk or just sort of trying it on, really. And Rob Muldoon drained his whiskey and then threw his ice at this young gang member. Well, the gang couldn't be more impressed. Here was a man who was not only hard drinking but prepared to stick up for himself, you know, two traits that the gang could only admire. So they had this amazing relationship, yeah, and he went out of his way to engage the gangs and sort of make work schemes. It was when unemployment was starting to climb, and the country sort of thought that it would be a temporary blip. So he thought if he could keep the gangs employed, they wouldn't become divorced from the labour market. So he put an enormous amount of effort in. But once he was gone, it certainly all disappeared.
Yeah. So was he successful in any way in?
Well, those schemes that he put in place, these sort of make-work schemes, were, I mean, there was no systematic evaluation of it. And so from this distance, because we're talking now sort of in the early 80s up until the mid-80s, it's difficult from this distance to assess it. But certainly at the time, anywhere from the politicians to the police to community leaders and from the gang members themselves were saying that it was stopping inter-gang violence by keeping them occupied. However, there were some high-profile abuses of the schemes, and they became an anathema to the free market ideals of the government that replaced his. You can't have make-work schemes in a free market economy, and so they were scratched.
Yeah.
And never to be seen, really. I mean, it was the only time that we've really, in New Zealand, although perhaps in recent times with some LA-style street gangs, we're starting to have some social initiatives, but in the history of patched gangs, the traditional gangs in New Zealand, it was really the only effort at not only seeing them having a social causation, not just being a criminal problem, but a social problem, and trying to deal with them and with social policies. Other than that, it's all been about just leaving it up to the cops and it being a law enforcement issue.
Right. With the more recent migration, so there's traditionally, as you're saying, it was the Europeans, the Maori, and some of the islanders as well. Now that you've got a much larger plethora of people coming from around the world in New Zealand, has there been a change in the face of gangs?
Well, we're starting to develop a quite a significant Asian population in New Zealand, but the reason we've got that, although we've got, ever since gold mining times back in the late 1800s, we've had a small Chinese population, but we haven't really had a significant Asian population since the 1990s, the early 1990s really, when the economy was incredibly dire, unemployment was high, and we were seeking capital from Asia, so we were attracting wealthy Asian people to come and migrate to bring capital with them to hopefully bolster or kickstart the economy. So what we've seen ever since really is a targeting of higher socioeconomic Asian people, and given that gangs tend to come from the lower socioeconomic classes, barring some errant sort of students who may be over here unsupervised, we haven't really got any other ethnic gang problems. Some organised crime problems potentially within Asian communities, but again, very, very minor. The Asian population in New Zealand tends to be very law-abiding.
Oh, well, okay. So it's very different. I mean, certainly in Australia and other places I've been, there tends to be in new migrant communities a brand new street gang problem, or a brand new street gang phenomenon, I probably should say, that develops. And that's quite unique that it's not happening over there.
Yeah, well, as I say, I see it as a socioeconomic issue, really. I think you don't tend to, certainly in New Zealand and in the literature I've seen around the world, you don't tend to get middle-class gangs. And if you do, they don't last long. They're a youthful adventure, and then they sort of fade away. And so, yeah, we just don't have it. So the communities that are most depressed in New Zealand that are faced with the greatest hardship tend to be Maori and Pacific communities, and hence why they are overrepresented in gang statistics. And interestingly, whilst one doesn't want to be too economically deterministic, I don't think you can deny it as a bedrock factor. But I mean, when the economy was at its worst in New Zealand and unemployment was at its highest, up around just over 10%, I think, in the early 1990s, it's no surprise that this started to bite into Pākehā or European New Zealanders. And so we see the advent of skinhead gangs and white power gangs. The correlation is all there for an influence, an economic influence, if not with other factors, obviously.
Right.
Which actually, which is one other thing, because I think the gangs have been so are dominated by Maori and Pacific peoples. I think in New Zealand, we've tended to rely on a fairly lazy interpretation of why that is, and I think you said it bandied about that it's because Maori and Pacific peoples are more tribal, so they're sort of more naturally inclined toward gang formation. I I think that's a nonsense. I think if the social conditions are right, Pākehā or European New Zealanders are just as apt at forming gangs as Maori and Pacific people. So I think we have to look elsewhere for explanation other than tribal.
Some strange anthropological.
Yeah. I just don't think it exists.
Yeah. So were there any changes in government responses? As you were saying, some of the gangs were changing. You had the rise of the skinheads. Has there also been any resurgence in stigmatisation or panics in the community about gangs?
Yeah, look, from time to time, we absolutely do. Yeah, I mean, and usually these are preceded by sort of catalytic events. You know, some sort of high profile, often horrific, violent crime that focuses the mind and the attention. Now, just at the moment, for example, there's heightened awareness because the Bandidos have just very recently come to New Zealand, and you know, suddenly we've got a new group, and so people, particularly the media, love it, don't they? And so suddenly there's sort of this high profile nature. Now, I think if there was any sort of incident to happen now, I think we've got all the conditions ready for a moral panic, really. But the gangs in New Zealand have aged, and LA-style street gangs aside, the gangs, the traditional gangs, the patch gangs, the average age has increased so much. And as we're aware, I think probably from personal experience as a man nearing 40 myself, and certainly from statistics, you know, men in their 40s and 50s aren't as likely to engage in violence, as quick to violent activities as men in their late teens or early 20s. Yeah. And so the gang violence that was so common in New Zealand in the 70s and the 80s, and even into the 1990s actually, is just so rare now. It just doesn't really happen to the same degree that it does. Now, I see in Australia, you have quite a lot of gang, and it appears to me from the media, and I guess I only see them when they make the media, but your bikies still seem to be battling it out, whereas ours have sort of come to some sort of uneasy truce. But what we've seen in recent years is an upswing, an upsurge after the outlaw bikers were sort of almost in a moribund state. They were looking to be in terminal decline. Certain groups were falling over. They weren't rejuvenating with new members. They were losing members very at a very rapid rate. Just in the last two or three years, we've seen this big upswing. Big, remarkable turnaround where it's become almost back in fashion again, the outlaw bikers. And these new groups either are forming in New Zealand, like the Rebels and the Bandidos, or it's sort of the, just indigenous groups are springing up in New Zealand. And I do wonder, it's just reminiscent of the early days of the scene when it was sort of forming here, when there was so much violence. And I wonder, in an ever-crowded room, someone is likely to get elbowed. So I think I just sense we're on there's a real chance that we may return to violence in the near future. There's a very, I mean, it's quite possible anyway.
Yeah. Well, I know the research I do, we've got the Finks over here and now just been patched over as Mongols. And the average age of the chapter on the Gold Coast is 42. So we've got that same aging population. Yeah. But the violence is not as widespread as it appears, I think, and it's much more associated where, we were talking before about the organised crime groups within the gangs. Yeah. The violence is actually the organised crime groups within the gangs rather than the gangs fighting the gangs, although the big brawl that was on the Gold Coast was over the fact that the president of one club was going out with the ex-girlfriend of the president of another club. And surprisingly, that's what caused the government crackdown on organised crime. Over a girl, so it wasn't even over drugs or anything. But
Well, this is, and you see here, we've had some, we had a violent incident. Oh, gee, it must be going back to about 2007 or 2006, perhaps, like a little while back now. Maybe 2008, sorry, I can't recall. And Whanganui, and there was a brawl at a service station initially between the Hells Angels and Mongrel Mob. And then not long after, there was a shooting where an innocent girl, a two-year-old, was shot in a gang shootout. Now, these were violent incidents, but the and terrible incidents, But but the response was to ban gang patches. So suddenly you've got a response that wouldn't have solved the problem in the first place. You know, somehow it just gets lost in translation. And the default position, even after those incidents, was all these brawls are all about, you know, drug crime, are all about territory for drugs. Well, they had absolutely nothing to do with drugs whatsoever. You know, I know what both started both instances, but it's just an easy default option for politicians.
No, I think so.
And it's very unhelpful. You know,
the response of banning clubs or patches says that they banned the entire clubs over here. It's almost like they say, well, this is all about organised crime, but we're going to respond to the club as a club instead of an organised crime group. So they're almost ignoring their own argument when they develop the response.
Yeah, look, I don't think politicians are often known for their logic and wisdom, but when it comes to gangs, they're at their worst.
Yes, it's
certainly in New Zealand. I mean, it's a disgrace because, you know, oftentimes they will have good intentions, but more often than not, there's just such an obvious cynical ploy to garner votes that it should be scorned on, and they should really be held up for the charlatans that they are.
Yeah. So where do you see gangs going in the future in New Zealand?
Gee, that's a tough old question. You know, with this upswing in the outlaw clubs, that really took me by surprise, I must say. But I think the future in New Zealand appears to me to be with the LA-style street gangs, so these Bloods and Crip-type gangs who no longer wear patches, who dress obviously like, you know, their American sort of namesakes. They're growing fast. They tend to be younger, so they have that violent component to them, which has disappeared a little bit with the older gangs. They, unlike the traditional patch gangs in New Zealand, who sort of were formed in that sort of hippie era and wanted to drop out of society and really didn't want for much, they wore rough clothes to sort of show their rejection of society, and they just sort of dropped out and sort of said they'd do their own thing. Unlike that, these new LA-style street gangs, based on sort of an MTV culture, want the bling, they want the flash cars, they want the gold jewellery, they want the big houses, they want the designer clothes. Now, if you've got those goals, but your means to achieve them is working in the warehouse at best, or perhaps the unemployment benefit, then you don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure out that that's going to lead to profit-driven crime. You know that they're going to reach for profit-driven crime. So I think we've got a more violence and more profit-driven crime with these young groups. And this transformation, I initially thought that many of these groups would just be, these young groups would just be absorbed into the traditional group. So the patched gangs like the Mongrel Bomb, Black Power would look at them, these young guys, and sort of go, well, who's got good form? We'll take him. And they'd, you know, sort of dissolve them like that, and they'd just sort of be assimilated into the mainstream groups.
Mm.
And I thought one of the reasons that would happen is because these young guys would actually end up in prison, find that a bit tough, and look, seek the protection of older groups as well. But what we're seeing quite clearly is that these groups are surviving in prison. So we're seeing the percentage increase in these younger groups grow and grow and grow. And obviously that's mirroring what's happening on the street. So I think without doubt they're the future of the New Zealand gang scene, and it's a very untidy future in that. And what is perhaps a little unfortunate is that this sort of revolution, if you will, within the scene is occurring almost, if not unnoticed, certainly no one's sort of really looking to do much about it. And I think that may well be to our detriment in the future. I think if we could look back in the 60s, 70s and 80s, say, and with what we know now, what we might have done differently, I think they'll be lamenting a similar sort of a similar situation in 10 years from now.
It's a bit strange, really, isn't it? You've gone sort of full circle. The gang started with people in New Zealand emulating American gangs in the former Hells Angels.
Yeah.
And then you've come back to them emulating gangster rap gangs.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Full circle is right. And which, again, though, does sort of make live this whole idea that the Americanization of sort of New Zealand society, which some sort of people bemoan, certainly, as far as gangs concerned, is not new. We've always been influenced by international trends. You know, we had the death head, we had the Hell's Angels death head in New Zealand before we had Ronald McDonald, you know, before we had the Golden Arches.
I just love the point in the book where you're actually saying they actually hand-painted it on themselves. They didn't even have proper patches, so they just bought leather jackets and painted it on.
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, great. So what's next for you then? Where you were saying you're actually on your own. You're not at a university. You're researching on your own. And what are you working on?
Yeah, well, I lecture at Canterbury University, but I just contract there, so I research for private clients. But I'm doing that really just to fund the book on doing murder, a history of New Zealand, as its working title. So I'm looking at murder and how that's influenced and changed New Zealand. So I've gone from one extremely big subject to a slightly bigger one, because obviously I'm a devil for punishment, but I'm hopeful, or I'm optimistic, if I'm nothing else.
That's fantastic. Love your optimism. I mean, and once again, you've got a nice small country, so you can grab a topic like that and run with it.
Yeah, hopefully so. Hopefully so.
Well, I hope I'm sure it will be as good as this book that we're discussing now. I suppose that's probably a good point to wrap it up. So, Jared Gilbert, thank you very, very much for this, talking to me today.
Well, absolute pleasure. Yeah. I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
No, that's all right. And yes, we've been talking to Jared Gilbert about his book, Patch, to the History of Gangs in New Zealand.